Welcome, guys. Max Mounter of the Accidental Engineer. Today we're joined by Rachel Maltiel-Swenson. Rachel is head of analytics of the Flex team at eBay, which is a cross-channel marketing analytics team. Do you mind sharing for our audience a little bit about your current role there and what your team does?
Yeah, so I started pretty recently at eBay, and we're within the team that does digital marketing. And we set up analytics in a, I think it's pretty unusual way, where we have different teams that directly support the marketing channels, so paid search, email, all of that. And then my team is the team that kind of takes on broader projects, cross-channel projects, projects that tend to take a little bit more time. They might be, you know, technically challenging or something like that. We're kind of the place where normally with analytics, there's all these ideas of like, it'd be really nice to look into this. Oh, but we have to put out this burning fire over here, so we don't have time to look into that. So we're kind of the team that can look into those longer-term ideas, and we're kind of removed from the day-to-day fires. We end up with a lot of like strategic, innovative projects that tend to take a little bit longer.
So a lot of our audience is curious about how to get into careers in marketing analytics and maybe the technical side of that, what skills they need to know. We can go all the way back to maybe college, about how you, what led your path, to being head of analytics of the Flex team?
Yeah, I got there totally by accident.
Okay.
So I can go all the way back. So in college, I majored in math and philosophy with no idea what I wanted to do. But those things were interesting, so I studied them. And then when it was time to graduate, I still had no idea what I wanted to do. And so I ended up taking a job at Bain & Company Strategy Consulting, which is a really good place to go when you have no idea what you want to do. you end up working on a lot of different cases or projects, usually across different industries, really different types of business questions. But they're all, you know, strategic business questions, and you solve them in really different ways. Sometimes it's, you know, a mathematical model. Sometimes it's interviewing people. Sometimes it's like wading through lots of like old journals. So you see lots of different techniques, you see different industries, you see different types of questions. And so for me, it was really good because I learned what I liked and what I didn't like. And I knew that I liked marketing. Like I liked where business kind of touched people and like, you know, decision theory and people's, what they liked and what they didn't like. But I, you know, Bain wasn't, I didn't want to stay there. You know, I did 2 years there and then I really liked the type of work, but the culture, the hours, all of that was a little challenging. And I thought that the direction that I wanted to go was I thought that it was important to answer these business questions. I recognized there was a lot of data. I wanted to be able to analyze the data better. And so I went and I got my master's in statistics. Actually, I went to get my PhD in statistics, and then I decided I didn't want to do that.
That's a really interesting story that I've heard many variations of.
Yes.
Starting the PhD program, which can be a 4 to 7
5 years would have been typical for statistics.
And a lot of people I know do not find the interest or will or desire,
yes,
to fulfill the 4+ years experience.
Yes.
So what was it that led you to reconsider completing the PhD program?
I would sit in my classes and we would like be learning these methodologies and techniques. I'd be like, oh, when I get a job someday, I really hope that I don't have to do this in my job. And I realized I was saying that about almost everything I was learning. And I was like, I don't know if finishing this is going to get me to exactly where I want to be. Mm-hmm. I liked the types of problems that statistics can be used to solve. But statistics grad school is about getting into like the really nuanced rules and assumptions. And like, are you sure you made the right assumptions? Are your standard errors perfectly proper? And from being at Bain, I recognized that a lot of companies don't even know like what's your average or like count this, right? Really, really basic things. And so I didn't need to know how to do like a hierarchical linear means model and make sure that I had the right assumptions for my standard errors to like have impact. A linear regression was probably going to have a lot of impact a lot of the time and go one step back. Like a mean versus a median was going to be able to have impact. And so I liked the really applied problems, and PhD level academic statistics was just getting very, very far from them. Mm-hmm. Super, super important for like medical studies, right? Medical studies need that really, really nuanced perfection in like your standard errors, because you're like figuring out if this drug is like saving lives and whether or not the side effect is statistically significant, like very, very important. But a lot of the like day-to-day people decision type of stuff, you could make a lot of impact there with like really simple stuff.
Well, one of the skills you were telling me about obtaining while you were doing the PhD program was R, and how R is a very popular tool in the statistical academic community as well as in industry. Do you mind sharing for our audience what kind of struggles you dealt with in learning R? Did you have programming experience before you entered your master's program?
Minimal. I went to a liberal arts college, so I studied a little bit of everything. So yeah. I did take, I think, one or two computer science classes in undergrad. But, you know, I mean, so I understood the basic, like, theories of computer science, but hadn't used R or anything like that at all. In grad school, you learn R because if you want to complete your homework, you have to, use R. And so, you know, I mean, in classes, you would get basic examples of like, and this is the line of code you do to write like a linear regression. But then, of course, you had to figure out how to do a lot more with it. I mean, honestly, I think some of the really hard stuff with R is like making your plots look fine, right? Like when you're trying to like move your legend up because it's covering your, you know, I mean, a lot of that was the stuff that ended up being really painful. But you start to, you just develop, like you do one homework and you save it. And so then next week when you have to do your next homework, you're like, oh, I remember, I figured out how to move my legend, and you just copy paste the code and bring it over. And in grad school, we also had a, like a statistical programming class. It was actually more focused on C++, although there was a little bit on R. Like, they taught you some of the theories of creating functions, right? Rather than just, like, writing your code to do something once, but, like, create a function so that you can, like, do things over and over again. So, although I have to admit, like, I was taught a lot of stuff that I don't necessarily always use in my day-to-day life.
For sure,
but,
for sure.
I have some formal training.
So when your motivations changed around the PhD program and it dawned on you that the work you were doing in the PhD program wasn't what you wanted to be doing for the rest of your life or career, what series of steps did you take to find your way into a job in private industry?
Yeah, so I knew I was going to be graduating in June. I needed to find a job. My husband was still in grad school, so we knew we were going to stay in Seattle. And so I just went online and read all sorts of job postings, and I wasn't going with a very specific path, right? I wasn't like, I want a job in marketing analytics. I was like, I want a job. And so, you know, I was looking for things that required, you know, I knew I wanted something that required something quantitative, right? I had math from undergrad. I had my master's in stats now. I wasn't walking all the way away from that. But I also knew I wanted something where you solve business problems. Mm-hmm. Those two conditions, if you're just looking at job descriptions, like almost any job description will tell you, like, some mathematical ability is helpful and will solve important, impactful business problems. So, and, you know, getting that first job when you're coming out with, like, something new is hard. You don't have, like, the connections. You don't have, like, all this great work experience. I had some, at least. I had Bain, which was nice, you know, versus just coming out with school. And so I just put my resume out into the black box of the internet.
Wow.
I think I probably applied to like 16 different jobs.
Okay.
I probably only heard back from like maybe three. And I got two job offers. So
that's a pretty good conversion rate.
Yeah, it's a pretty good conversion rate for the online black box of dead resumes.
So once you found your job at Expedia, how long were you there for again?
I was at Expedia for 3 years. Mm-hmm. A variety of different roles over the years. I started in a cross-channel analytics role. It's kind of similar to the role I have now, but it was just me versus like a team. Cross-channel, lots of strategic types of projects.
I think a lot of our audience, some of them may be familiar with cross-channel analytics, but for people who are not in marketing analytics, do you mind breaking down what cross-channel
means? So normally in digital marketing, you think about the different channels, which is just the different ways that you can acquire customers. Paid search, right? All the ads you click on Google, social, right? Facebook, Pinterest, Snapchat, all of that stuff now. Email marketing is a big one. Display, which is just banner ads you see around the web, and different companies will have different flavors of what works in their industry. But then cross-channel is just usually when you're thinking about marketing across all of those things, which oftentimes marketing is thought of, you know, in those channels distinctly. But you can imagine that it can be very impactful if you click on this Google ad about, you know, like cool basketball shoes or something like that, and you don't actually transact. And then if we show you an email about cool basketball shoes, right, because we recognize where you are in a journey and we try to keep talking to you. I will note that not very many companies are actually doing that type of streamlined stuff as well as they would like to be. But cross-channel tends to be things that can have impact in lots of channels. So, you know, if you're thinking about the messaging of your marketing or the measurement of your marketing or the creatives of your marketing, you can solve those things in ways that can work for lots of channels. So that tends to be the types of things that I've worked on, as opposed to like focused on a specific channel.
So the signals that buyers of Expedia might give off about where they're at in their journey of wanting to buy a travel package or airplane tickets are probably significantly different than the buying signals of an eBay customer. How drastic of a change was that in role? I realize in between Expedia and now eBay, you worked at Pinterest, but what's kind of the diversity of buying signals that people give off?
Yeah. So I've only been at eBay 4 months, so I'm definitely still wrapping my head around it because, you know, 3 years of intuition that I built up at Expedia rears its head sometimes at eBay. But, you know, I mean, one really basic thing is usually when you're booking travel, you don't, like, wake up one day and you're like, I think I might go to Hawaii. And then, like, an hour later, you book your trip to Hawaii, right? Usually it's more like, we haven't taken a vacation in a while. Maybe we should go someplace. And then you go home, you talk to your significant other, then you like debate back and forth where you go. And, you know, 3 months later, maybe you're booking a trip, right? It's a very long purchase cycle. eBay sells all sorts of things, but, you know, clothes, for example, right? Like, it's a little bit more realistic that you wake up one day and you're like, I think I'd like some new shoes. And then you buy them. And then the end, and you move on with your life. But, you know, from a digital marketing perspective, this matters. One thing that's very common and very important in digital marketing is attribution. And it's completely analytics driven, you know, measurement. It's the math of who gets credit for what transaction, right? Because what tends to happen is you click a link in paid search, and then you click an email you get, and then maybe you get an ad on Facebook, and you click all those things, and then you purchase. Well, who's all three of those teams want to say that they drove that purchase, but attribution is about figuring out who gets the credit. And it's, there are a lot of people spending a lot of time thinking about this. At Expedia, our attribution covered a 30-day window because it is very realistic that you are shopping for travel over 30 days. At eBay, our logic is 1 day.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. And it's things that are being explored and thought about, right? I mean, I wouldn't say that at eBay we think that we're like done and we can just move on with it. Like, that's actually something we're thinking about right now. Is that correct or not? But really, I believe that eBay and Expedia are very different for that time to purchase. You know, but also, like, it's also like, is one size fits all, right? Like, it might take me 30 days to book a trip, but it might take you a week. It might take somebody else 3 months, right? But you just kind of have to come up with rules and logic and hope it works.
This sounds like a really intractable problem, this attribution problem. Is there any maybe 20-year-off solution that will solve the problem cross-industry?
I mean, some people would tell you that they've solved the problem across industry now. Okay. There are third-party solutions that you can bring in for attribution that use various mathematical models, and they differ in how they do, right? There are some that have much more, like, models with lots of variables that capture all the different things, with the premise that, like, I can show you an ad in email and I can show you an ad on Facebook, and if they use the same creative, maybe I should think of those similarly, right? Like, maybe that information should be grouped together. So companies do more like model things. Other companies do more like paths, right? Like, if you click display and then email, and then I just click display and then purchase and you purchase, right? We can compare all the people like you, compare all the people like me, look at the difference in conversion rates, and you can say that email click, you know, if your group is higher conversion, well, email has this lift in conversion. So there are third-party solutions that do that right now. But
you sound deeply skeptical about those offerings.
No, I think that there's a lot of really good advanced models. it's a question right now of like build or buy, right? It's a very common question in technology. What do you do in-house versus what do you outsource? Attribution is a hard one to outsource because you're giving away all your data. This other company is telling you who gets credit for what, and you might not fully understand the logic. You probably don't know all the underworkings of the mathematical model. You probably don't even get back fully granular data of click A drove transaction B. So I actually think a lot of the third-party solutions are probably pretty good, but it can be a hard thing to fully remove from the company.
Because of organizational buy-in and bureaucratic concerns and legitimate ones too.
Yeah, like obviously. Understanding what happened, right? Because like what's going to happen, okay, you work with this third party, 6 months later, all of your paid search numbers go down. What happened? How do we fix it? Well, that's really hard to figure out if you don't understand how paid search is getting credit for the numbers that it has.
Or you find out that they were calculating something wrong and you don't have accountability in place. There's not, as you can have all of the SLAs in the world, but there's not the same effect as firing somebody, I guess.
Yeah.
Build versus buy is a super interesting problem. Is that something that you've dealt with throughout your career post-grad school?
Not a ton. I mean, I'm dealing with it a little bit right now, but not a ton. Companies do differ in what they build versus buy. Honestly, I think a lot of the analytics build versus buy questions, they're almost a little like upper funnel of us because there's a lot of build versus buy in terms of how do you track the data, how do you log the data, how do you store the data, which query tool do you use, right? Some of that sort of stuff, which it affects us, but the data engineering team is the one who makes a lot of those decisions. There are options where you can bring in third-party solutions to do various analytical things. I mean, dashboard tools, of course. Attribution is one, but you can have, there are third-party tools that do A-B testing. There are third-party tools that do cohort models. I've always worked in big companies that have had big analytics teams. And I think the build versus buy question is very different when you're a small company, you have two analysts.
Oh, for sure.
You're trying to keep everything going, then you probably should be buying a lot. eBay has around 60 to 70 digital marketing analysts,
wow.
Which we are we are one team of analysts. I think there are probably 10 to 20 teams of our size across eBay. So we're in a bit of a different, I think that puts us in a different position for build versus buy.
So feel free to punt on this question because I realize this might be non-public information, but what tools do you guys buy?
I mean, I don't know everything, probably. Well, I'm sure I don't know everything, but common things that just for day-to-day being an analyst type of thing, we use Hadoop and Teradata, I've used Hadoop and Teradata at previous jobs. Those are very common query tools. Dashboard stuff, there's stuff all over the place. Tableau is certainly used with some frequency at eBay, but there's less of a consistent, this is our one dashboard tool versus what I've actually seen at other companies. Pinterest, we had our own internal dashboard tool. And at Expedia, we used ClickView, which is not quite as common as Tableau, but I actually really liked it. those are some of the kind of most common analytical tools. And I think we're probably only now really starting to think about the next level, right? The cohort tools or the attribution tools, things like that. And every place I've worked has had a lot of internal stuff for A/B testing versus just completely outsourcing.
One of the things that I'd love to hear you tell our audience is to kind of reassure people who might be apprehensive about learning the toolkit that you've learned. I mean, you learned R in grad school. You're also mentioning before we hit record about learning SQL, how relatively easy it is to learn. I think it would be great to hear about your experience learning SQL and how I realize you use it a lot less now that you're in a pretty senior managerial role. But for people who might be earlier in their careers, what was learning SQL like?
Yeah, so they don't teach SQL in grad school.
Yeah.
But you need SQL for any job where you're going to be touching data. And so before my interviews, I did, like, the really basic, like, select star from, right? Like, okay, I know what an inner join is versus an outer join. I've never done one, but I know what it is from reading it on Wikipedia type of stuff. And so then when I started my job, I had to actually, you know, use it. My manager told me that a really good analyst, it's not that they are the best at writing code, it's that they know how to, basically they know how to get code, which doesn't necessarily mean writing it themselves. So he taught me to always, like, ask around, does anybody else have an example query that I can work off of? And so I learned a lot of SQL just from other people's shared code to, you know, do whatever, you know, access the data tables that I was then trying to access, and I could figure out how to modify it. And so I learned from seeing other people's examples. And I've always worked at companies where, like, people were really happy to help each other. Because everyone also, like, they could, it wasn't that far ago that they didn't know SQL or they didn't know this specific left join trick or whatever. And so people were very happy to share and teach. But I learned a lot just from, like, seeing other people's queries. And actually, because in my last two jobs, I started in those companies as a manager. So I didn't have as much time to, like, learn the data. So how did I learn the data? I asked people to share their queries with me. Mm-hmm. And so then I could see what were the tables they were using, how did they access it, what were the fields called, where did they get their fields. And so I learned a lot just from seeing whatever everyone else did. And as a manager, if I had somebody new joining my team, that's exactly what I would tell them to do, right? Like, oftentimes I might try to give someone a first project where they're modifying something that somebody else did. That's so a great way to start learning.
It sounds like analytics roles, there's an expectation that you do know SQL, but in your first analytics role out of grad school, you didn't know it as well as maybe some of your peers did, but this is something where if you rely on your coworkers and if you're kind to your coworkers, you can always get help.
Basically any analytics interview will ask a SQL question. I can't actually remember if I had a SQL question in my interview at Expedia, but I'm sure if I did, I'm sure I was not amazing. I've spoken with my manager about it later, because I think now it might be a little bit harder to get a job with the level of SQL that I had when I got that job, because I think the industry's gotten a little more competitive. But his take on it, and the take that I've had when I've hired people since then, was, you know R, or you know some other programming thing. SQL's really easy. You can probably pick it up. Mm-hmm. So I would say that, like, myself as a hiring manager, I'm looking for, you know how to do something programming-wise. If it's SQL, great. If it's not, and you have other strengths, that may be okay. Mm-hmm.
I think it's a really amazing story that you put your resume out into the wilderness of the internet and ended up with a couple of offers. For people who you'd advise as a hiring manager on the other side of the table, what do you recommend to analytics job seekers today?
The first thing I'll say is, when you don't get a job, it probably has almost nothing to do with you, which isn't super helpful for getting a job, but is at least helpful to, like, take those rejections in stride, right? It is really hard to write a good job description. The way that we do jobs, and, like, I'll just write, like, 8 bullet points and then here's, like, a paragraph, and, like, obviously now you understand everything you'll be doing for the next 2 years of your life. No, it doesn't cover it at all. And every time I've hired, I've had in my mind, what am I kind of looking for to shape out my team, right? That's how I approach hiring, right? I'm trying to build a team. And so I might be like, I have 3 people on my team who are, like, really strong technically, like, they have R, Python, their SQL's really good, but, like, I can really use someone who can really help to, like, tell the business story. You know, I want someone who's going to be, like, really good at, like, creating PowerPoint slides and telling the story and honing in on the right questions to, like, really solve what the business is looking for. And so I may get a whole bunch of resumes that are, like, super strong technically, but they're just not what I'm looking for right now. And people aren't very good at, like, indicating that nuance in a job posting. I mean, I can't write a job description that's like, I already have a bunch of technical people on my team, so this next person, I'm looking for somebody who's really good at telling a story, right? Like, you can't write that in a job description. So, mm-hmm. Oftentimes, like, yeah, I have rejected people that were really, really great. They just weren't what I needed to round out my team right then and there. Beyond that, like, Yeah, your resume should make really clear what your skills are. Your resume should make clear what your impact is, right? I don't just want to know that you can query data, right? I want to know that you can, like, drive business decisions and make things happen and, like, you know how to approach a problem. I mean, I think analytics fits really well for, like, the liberal arts background because it's not just, like, can you come in and do math? It's also, are you, like, strategic and do you know how to solve business problems? Okay, now put those two together. And so that, I think, is, like, what really makes the good analyst. I actually often think that, you know, the good analyst is someone who can do all the technical things they have to do. The great analyst is usually someone who can tell the story and knows how to approach a problem and knows how to prioritize and stakeholder management and the numbers. Your business person isn't going to like these numbers. They're really low. How are you going to approach that, right? And so I think those are the things that often kind of set someone apart. But you have to have, you know, you have to be able to do the math, right? I can't have someone who can only tell a story.
Of course. This has been fantastic. I think we've gotten a ton of information. Thank you for sharing your experiences. This has been amazing.
Sure.